Welcome. It's 5 minutes after 1 o'clock. The House Judiciary Committee is in session. In attendance are Representative Lynn, Representative Gruenberg, myself, Representative Ramirez, Representative Dahlstrom, Representative Holmes, and Representative Gatto. Our friend Representative Olson is with us today in the audience. We do expect Representative Coghill here shortly, or else we would be happy to share a seat. The purpose of today's meeting is to have an in-depth, narrow but far-reaching dialogue with esteemed Attorney General Talis Colberg. Prior to that, just a little bit of housekeeping for the committee. We have been working, as most members know, we were tasked by Speaker of the House Harris in the latter part of the summer, as we saw a broad disparity in pricing on retail gasoline. And we were tasked to produce a report on retail gasoline that most members of this committee and the 25th legislature participated in. We met in September, October, November, December, and January, I believe. And to that end, the committee is going to put out a report in draft form to each of the members of this committee on Thursday. I have sat through up in Fairbanks the Interior Issues Council, and I watched a good report get edited by a group of 20 or 30 people, and I don't wish to participate in another exercise like that. So the Vice Chair and I, our decision was to release a draft to the members of this committee by end of business tomorrow, and we would invite the members of this committee to add their own addendum, up to 5 pages, longer if necessary, and we would like for you to turn that addendum in on Monday as we convene into our committee session. I'll give you a number of days to digest the draft version of the report and then to add your own thoughts in the form of an addendum. Then we will produce just in office printers or building printers 60 copies. And we will pass those out to we will vote the report out of the committee with attached commentary on the record, and then we will produce 60 copies for members of this building and make an electronic version available, and then we will go out to the printer and produce bound copies for your constituents and interested parties here in the building and around the state, so they'll be available for mail for your offices as well as available electronically. And I wanted to, we think that's a very efficient format. General, we would like to thank you very much for the extraordinarily positive working relationship that we enjoyed with Ed, thank you, that we established and enjoyed with Ed Sniffen, who is the Attorney General for the Consumer Protection Division. He has been terrific to work with, and we look forward to seeing his report and the subject matter that it will cover. We are grateful with you here to tell you that some of the slides that we have included in our report were from Barry Pulliam in Econ 1, and that it was a very positive working relationship, and we look forward to not only the overlap in the report that your office puts out, but also the broader footprint that's covered by both of the reports. So we thank you for that. As to today's subject matter, this is scheduled as an overview. We have been tasked today by the sitting Speaker of the House, Chenault, to bring the Attorney General before us, and we're delighted to have you here. And the purpose of this discussion is not to rehash Troopergate, but to ascertain what you believe the relationship is between our two branches of government, and whether you believe that legislative subpoenas have any force with executive branch employees and your department when legally issued. Members, you will find in your packet quite a collection of documents. Some of my questions will center around an exchange of correspondence from Mr. Barnhill and Mr. Kohlberg to Hollis French. And I will remind folks in this room and those on gavel to gavel that it was a, we're joined by Representative Coghill. And I will remind folks here that that there was a unanimous vote, I believe, by Ledge Council that impaneled the Senate Judiciary Committee to investigate this issue as it arose, and that the House Judiciary Committee acted in an advisory capacity and attended all of those meetings. And as I say, we were uniquely tasked by the Speaker of the House to look into the issues that have been raised regarding separation of powers. Now, I am a layperson. I'm not an attorney, nor do I aspire, to be one. So I will have a few questions myself, but I will rely on the attorneys that are paneled here, Representative Gruenberg and Representative Holmes, to take the lead in questioning. But no other members should feel. I'm going to feel a little bit self-conscious, but no other members should feel as if they can't chime in at the time. I know, speaking for myself, General, it was a tough situation, and I saw quite a rift develop amongst those folks in my own party. I had never met Mr. Branchflower before, and I had the opportunity to meet him, and I watched unfold all the unique circumstance that swept across Alaska. The considerable honor that was bestowed upon our governor as the vice presidential nominee. I saw prior to that the issue that triggered today's overview raise its head, and I watched the Branchflower report being put together. I also saw what I regarded as a whitewash report, with the Petunias report, and it's, I'm just speaking only for my own opinion. I was quite troubled by the Truth Squad, and what I thought I saw, which was the state of Alaska's legislative branch co-opted by outside forces, and it was quite troubling for me as a person who takes my duty here in the state of Alaska. You know, we're all sworn to uphold the Constitution, and it was very troubling to see us get swamped by people that were sticking their nose under the tent of Alaska's business, and I found it troubling and offensive, and I was troubled that you were a part of that drama, with that, I would ask you to offer an opening statement, and then I have some questions, but I'd be happy to defer to some of the other members at the table. General Kohlberg, it's welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'll just briefly try to respond with where you left off. Neither me or my office have anything to do with the Truth Squad that you're referring to. The preliminary part of your opening statement talks about whether we feel a legislative subpoena has force when properly issued, and the answer to that is, was, and remains yes. We were asserting what we believed were legitimate legal questions about the particular subpoenas that were issued, not about the legislature's right to investigate or to issue subpoenas. This has become a topic of repeated statements, often in opinion columns or elsewhere, but have been picked up by people without correction, that somehow the Attorney General or the law office of the Attorney General's positions have somehow asserted that there cannot be legislative subpoenas or investigations. That's not the case. And it's not just simply today. I mean, all you have to do is look at what is in the public record in terms of court filings, and I suppose most directly, about 2 months ago, the seven employees' appeal is distinct, challenging the validity of the subpoenas they received rather than the general authority of the legislature. That was our pleading and our argument. Now, what happened in the course of the court proceedings was another lawsuit was filed that was joined with our lawsuit, which is not our position. It was, in fact, the position of some of your colleagues. That went more to the heart of the issue of the legitimacy, I suppose, of the proceeding itself. That is not the argument of the Department of Law or my attorneys. We have never, as it has been suggested over and over again by different people, ordered or directed people not to obey subpoenas. We have given them legal options, and the options they took were based on legal arguments that we had and issues we had with how these particular subpoenas were issued, not whether the legislature can issue a subpoena. What we did is not extraordinary or unusual. Subpoenas can be questioned in courts of law and proceedings, and they, in fact, can be questioned in legislative investigations. And what we did was not unprecedented in a legislative investigation. In fact, in your own bodies, in 1984, one of your former colleagues, then Senator Jalmer Kurtula, challenged a legislative subpoena. It was a subpoena that was upheld in Superior Court, but ultimately the Supreme Court quashed that subpoena. That is something that has been done. We were doing something for similar reasons, different arguments, but what we did was not unprecedented, and it was not a challenge to the legislature's ability to investigate or to issue a subpoena. It was how this particular set of subpoenas were issued. Legal arguments, not on the fundamental question of the legitimacy of a legislative investigation.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I might as well go ahead and jump on in. First of all, thank you for being here today. I do very much appreciate you coming in and talking with us today. And my interest in this is less to rehash Troopergate for the interest of doing that, and more to figure out what happened, who did what, where the two branches went right and where they were wrong, how we can make this work in the future. Both as an attorney and as a member of the legislative body, I obviously have a vested interest in figuring out the extent of our right to issue these subpoenas and how in the future the two branches of government are going to work together so that we don't come to the brink of a constitutional crisis. It's not really in anybody's best interest. So my interest here is to sort of figure out going forward how we can lay out procedures so that this will work. And I'm also heartened to hear that you did not at any time tell any of your clients not to comply with subpoenas, but rather it sounds like gave them options. That's refreshing to hear. In challenging a subpoena, I guess one of my concerns is the timing of the challenge. As I recall, this body, this committee sat in a joint session with the Senate Judiciary, and the Senate Judiciary authorized a number of subpoenas. About half of those were served fairly soon thereafter. Some of those were complied with, and some of those were not. The others were not served originally, as I understood it, based on an agreement that had been discussed and I thought reached between the two branches, between the legislature and the executive branch, about the conditions under which those individuals would cooperate without a subpoena. When that agreement broke down, those subpoenas, as I understood it, were then issued. A lawsuit was subsequently brought, but not until after the dates on which most of those subpoenas, especially the first group that was served, about half those people didn't show up for the subpoenas, and no court proceeding was brought until much later. And I guess I'm concerned that although I recognize the right to challenge a subpoena in court, I'm not sure I recognize the right to simply ignore the subpoena date and wait several days or a week or more after that date to go to a court and see whether or not you were right in not showing up. And I guess I would be interested in your thoughts on that.
Okay, I'm going to answer. You've thrown me a little bit, and I'm just...
It was a long question, I understand, Mr. Chairman.
There apparently were people who we didn't represent who may not have shown up, but the seven people that we represent, as I understand the timeline, and I'm pretty confident about this because I've gone over this preparing for today, none of those seven were scheduled to appear before we filed a court action on their behalf. So in regard to the people we represented, and we didn't necessarily represent everyone that was involved in this investigation, there were private attorneys involved, and I can't speak to what some of those other actions may have been. Now, to fill out the timeline a little bit more, you refer to an agreement which has become a topic for several people at different points in this discussion. When the subpoenas were first brought up as a concept, there was reference to possible criminal proceedings, which alarmed my staff about what was happening and the nature of what the subpoenas might be issued for. And that brought about an agreement where specific things were going to not be addressed in the way they had initially been proposed. It was not an agreement that would bind people for perpetuity to not have other issues which subsequently led them to, after that occurred, to assert their rights unrelated to the reasons for that particular agreement being brought about. The subpoenas were challenged within 2 days of when the last one was issued before the people were scheduled to appear in the case of the seven that we represent. So I would beg to differ that any of the people that my department represented, being those seven, failed to file a court action before they were scheduled to appear. In addition to that, my office specifically attempted to alleviate the clash that was about to occur by asking that the subpoenas be withdrawn in the interim, even as that was happening. I would also add something that seems to have escaped a lot of at least the media's attention, that after the Superior Court ruling on these, all seven of the people that we represented agreed to appear, agreed to provide statements, and did so before the conclusion of the investigation. And I would add that the timeline for the investigation and the deadline that was self-imposed by the investigation on itself was met by the seven statements. So all seven of the people who challenged the subpoenas agreed to make themselves available before the end of the investigation. And furthermore, there was no particular legal reason why the investigation had to end on that day as opposed to now or later. And it was within the power of the investigator to either take the statements into consideration which he had received or to follow up with more questions. So I think in terms of institutional perceptions and institutional concerns, again, I would reiterate what has been used over and over again. No one of the seven that we represented ignored a subpoena. There was no one not showing up. They were taking a legal option that has been tried before in other proceedings and even, as I mentioned before, in this institution, to follow up on their legal options in a timely manner. It was not an after, we didn't show up, and then we'll sue.
General.
Yes.
Again, I'm a layperson. If I could just interrupt for a moment. I'd just like to take a second to try and channel Ramona Barnes. I don't entirely understand what you said, so let me just put it to you in just a much more base fashion. Who do you work for? Because it didn't feel to me that you were working for Alaskans. I couldn't tell who you were working for, and you managed in your introductory remarks to skip over that part of my question, so perhaps I didn't ask it plainly enough. Who do you work for?
Mr. Chairman, I work for several people at the same time. In terms of where I think you're going, and you will, I'm sure will clarify this, whose legal interests do I represent? I think it is in the interests of all Alaskans that they have the understanding that they are represented in proceedings, that people who work for them in state government are accessing legitimate, proper legal advice so that their work is being handled in a way that they know they can conduct their job and know that they have legal representation as well. This is a job that, if you walk through the statute about the description of the job, it does have multiple hats. And certainly there were tensions that were coming about because of these proceedings, and in no small way obviously led to one of the more awkward situations for me, which is to recommend that the governor get independent counsel, so we did not even represent the governor in these proceedings because of the things that arise when you have multiple roles, and your ultimate duty here is to see that people are given proper access to their constitutionally given rights, to exercise those rights, and to not get too crosswise with other institutions that are involved at the same time. So it's a multi-answer to you: is the people, the state of Alaska, the Constitution, the departments, the state employees, and under other normal circumstances, it would be the governor. In this case, it could not be.
Well, General, I appreciate your answer to what I regarded as an Orwellian experience for the state of Alaska, because my recollection is that we stumbled through the first step of recommending that the governor get independent counsel. And then it was quite unclear to me whether you were representing Alaskans, the executive branch, the candidacy of the Republican Party, who I supported through the election cycle, or 14 people, or 7 people, or the 4 people whom Mr. Barnhill said would come before you, and then 3 days later, who you said would not come before the legislature. So I'm a layperson, like most Alaskans, and the whole affair was messy and sloppy to me, and cast a black eye on Alaska and the manner in which we handle our due process. And so I was just looking for an explicit answer. I work for the governor, these 14 people, and all Alaskans. But I'm having a hard time following.
You want one to be chosen, is what you're saying.
I appreciate that it's a multiple, but I'm just trying to, I'm a lay person approaching this job with some degree of confidence now that I've done it for a couple of years, and having watched this affair unfold over the summer and the fall. So just.
Well, Mr. Chairman, as a lay person, how would you envision the, when you say representing the people, how would that have materialized in your view as a lay person? Different from what happened here.
I had a hard time following who you were representing.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think we made it clear who we were representing. We were representing, in this lawsuit, 7 subpoenaed individuals who work for the state of Alaska. I mean, if you're asking me to prioritize who is more important, it's not unlike asking me which of my children I love most. It doesn't have to be asked that way, and it doesn't ultimately get answered in the way that would make you say you have to answer it this one above this one. These are all obligations that we take seriously, that I have an enormous staff that did their conscientious best to walk through in an unprecedented sort of circumstances to do it right. And I think ultimately a little bit of mischaracterization has led this to being more confusing than it needs to be. But we tried to separate out our obligations to who we had to represent. In this situation, multiple parties were involved. We assigned the governor to an independent counsel. My staff represented the 7 employees. I think in both instances, we were serving the people of Alaska and their interests by doing that.
So Representative Gatto has a question. I interrupted your line of question. Let me go back to Representative Holmes and then to Gatto, and then to Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned yourself earlier on.
I'm sorry. Back to Representative Holmes for her line of question, and then Representative Gatto. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you, Mr. Chairman, for that line. I've shared your confusion over time as to who was being represented at what point. And going back a little bit to part of my very long, drawn-out original question, of who was making the calls here. Was it the individual clients making the call? Was it the people who were issued subpoenas, or people who were asked to testify who were saying, I'm not going to testify, or was it your office that was saying you shouldn't testify? I'm looking at a letter that was signed, I believe, on your behalf by Assistant Attorney General Barnhill on the 9th of September. And it starts by saying the purpose of this letter is twofold. First, to explain why the Department of Law decided not to proceed with the depositions of the Department of Administration employees last week. Not why my clients decided not to participate. It's why the Department of Law decided not to proceed. That phrasing troubles me a little bit, because in other letters you talked about the difficult position that some of these employees, and I don't mean to minimize it at all, they were in a difficult position. Many of these people do work at the pleasure of the governor. They're at-will employees. They can be hired and fired as she likes. But they also work for the state of Alaska. And there was a legislative subpoena asking them to show up. And one of the rationales in your letters for saying we don't want to show up is they're in a difficult position. They're either going to make the governor mad, or they're, in my view, going to break the law and not show up for a subpoena. Who is making the calls here?
Ultimately, the clients make the calls. You yourself, through the chairman, Representative Holmes, have worked for the Department of Law. I don't think there's anyone who was involved in this matter in the Department of Law that came to work for the department after I got there. These are career people, and I think you know enough about the atmosphere there to know that these folks are just doing what they think is a proper legal job. They're not there as political appointees by me or anyone else to achieve a particular end. And one thing I didn't address that Representative Ramirez referred to again is what you had previously mentioned, was do these people in the Department of Law work for the Republican Party? And emphatically, no. There was no one in my department taking direction from the Republican Party or the campaign. And that is, just because that's been brought up twice now, needs to be clarified. The clients were given options. We do not direct, and I think your own experience would lead you to believe that it would be incredible to believe that attorneys in the Department of Law, career employees, would go out of their way in any circumstance to tell a client that you have to choose this option or you must take this direction. These are choices that were given to them. Now, you're making a reference to a letter that I don't have an instant recollection of, but it's possible that Mr. Barnhill wrote something that was at that point a conclusion that he more characterized more as a department position than an employee position, but ultimately it would have been the clients that were being represented and the clients' views that were being pursued here. Thank you.
Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not a lawyer. I'm a layperson. But I'm a layperson with substantial experience in the courtroom. And just by coincidence, the Attorney General was contacted by me, I believe, almost 5 years ago in his office before he was appointed. And I asked him a question about how to proceed on a small claim. And he gave me some advice. And we are still involved in this small claim 4 years plus. Here's why that's important. It's all going on because of legal challenges, perfectly legitimate questions that take time to answer. And my name is on this document here because of a legal challenge. Nothing in here violates the law. Anybody has a right to make a legal challenge to a process that's going on. And the question has come several times that sort of suggests that the reason for this is to create an event or delay an event that had to happen by a date certain. That was really most of the challenge. Why did we have to have a date certain? But the challenge was perfectly legal. And we were defeated in that challenge. So I will agree that maybe things didn't go the way I thought legally they should have gone. But what I have found was what has happened from the Attorney General's department was that they were legal. And if the Attorney General is on trial here, and I've gotten this feeling since the beginning that he is sitting here as a defendant. Is that the direction we were supposed to be going with today, or rather to hear some sort of an overview? Because that you talked about your feeling about what had happened, and now I'm talking about my feeling, and that's the suggestion I'm getting from some of the comments that you have made and Representative Holmes have made.
Thank you for your insight, Representative Gatto. I'm very comfortable with the fashion in which we're proceeding. Some of us, myself included, felt that the Attorney General advised clients to defy a subpoena. And that's what we're here for, is to discuss the issue of separation of powers, in my mind, and what I thought you did, systemic damage to the rights of the legislature to bring an appropriate subpoena against somebody, and that the rights that any normal citizen would have had and the obligations that any normal citizen would have had to ignore a subpoena at their own peril. Instead, you empowered these seven or four people with super rights, and that they were advised that they, by you, that they could ignore a subpoena. And that's how I recollect this. And frankly, with all due respect, Representative Gatto, I've been waiting months and months and months to have this conversation. We can call it an overview or anything that we want, but I want to uncover exactly what went wrong and the manner in which the legislative branch was compromised by the Attorney General's office. And I'm rather incensed about what transpired here some months ago. So it was my intention to have a hearing exactly like this with the Attorney General. But your point of view is always welcome. Representative Gatto?
Well, we agree on that. He was asked a question and he answered it, that he allowed choices, obviously legal choices. They made the choice. But the accusation seems to be that he was involved in their choice. May have been, but that's what an attorney would do. He said, here are the options you have. They accepted one of the options and moved forward. We covered that line of questioning. It seems like we're still there.
Mr. Chairman, if I might.
General.
First of all, I'm a little chagrined that I would have had anything to do with a small claim that would last 5 years, and I am not involved in that. I would just, again, for the record, point out that it is not at all accurate to suggest that we told anyone to ignore a subpoena, and we did not try to empower anyone with super rights, but we tried to make them aware of their normal constitutional rights and options in this situation.
Well, with all due respect, then, General, did in this letter of September 16th to Senator French, did all four of these people just contact you? I mean, did they conference in and all decide all at the same time that they were going to ignore the subpoena? I mean, why didn't it generate four separate letters? How did these clients act as a group in chorus with one another? Why wouldn't there have been four separate letters and four separate contacts between the 13th when we have a note from Mr. Barnhill saying each of these four individuals have confirmed that they wish to proceed with their deposition without service of a subpoena and that they have elected to have representation from law at their deposition. Law will provide that representation. Their availability is as follows. And then 3 days later, in a letter signed by you, it says your committee has subpoenaed certain employees of the executive, of the executive branch. Now, I will read to you just so that we're all on the same page, Representative Gatto. Section 24.25.010, issuance in form of a subpoena, B. A subpoena requiring the attendance of a witness before a standing or special committee of the legislature may be issued by the chairman of a committee when authorized to do so by a majority of the membership of the committee and with the concurrence of the president or the speaker or with the concurrence of the House or the Senate. Now, I happened to be in attendance at that meeting, as was the vice chair, when we were in an advisory capacity. Three members of the Senate Judiciary voted in that fashion. I believe it was Senators Wilikowski, Senator French, and the sitting rules chairman, Senator Huggins. And that order was signed by the President of the Senate, Lyda Green, and those subpoenas were issued. And then after that, it my recollection is that they were advised not to show up for those subpoenas.
Again, they were not advised not to show up for the subpoenas. In answer to the question, Mr. Chairman, about why there weren't seven individual letters, Had they had different positions, had, say, three of them said we want to comply and four had said we want to proceed with challenging these, there would have been probably two letters. I suppose in theory it could have been seven redundant letters, but since they were taking the uniform position in this case and you didn't have anyone that was taking the other option, that's why you would have one letter. Again, I cannot overemphasize that you keep characterizing this as directed, advised, or told to ignore. The lawsuit that was filed outlines the five reasons why these subpoenas were thought to be infirm and why they were challenged. And you have one view of it, and we thought there was a legitimate legal argument for a contrary view on the manner in which these particular subpoenas were challenged. And as in other cases, in cases before this same body, they were exercising their option to seek redress.
Representative Brumberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kohlberg, General Kohlberg, I always think that's a military term.
It's
not here.
On your
As we briefly discussed, my questions to you today won't focus so much on what has happened, but rather the legal issues, the broader legal issues involved. In some of the earlier correspondence, I think it was the September 16th letter, the lengthy letter you wrote on September the 16th, alluded to the fact that now let me just ask you one question before I get there. On September the 16th, had the subpoenas been issued?
Yes, it says your committee has subpoenaed certain employees of the executive branch.
Okay, because I was slightly confused with that. And at that point, in the final paragraph of that letter, you state, do you not, that if they're not withdrawn, our clients will not appear.
I beg to clarify that. Apparently they were issued but not yet served at that point.
Ah, okay. Okay, well, that certainly answers
my question. Would you repeat that answer?
They've been issued but not served. So they're not effective until they're served, and I would certainly agree with that. Do you happen to have that letter in front of you, sir?
Yes, that was.
Did the members of the committee also? I'd like to refer to the second paragraph in that letter.
Which letter is that?
September 16, from General Kohlberg to Senator Hollis Branch. And if I may read from time to time from the letter. As state employees, our clients have taken an oath to uphold the Constitution, etc., and for that reason, they respect the legislature's desire to carry out an investigation in support of its lawmaking powers. However, our clients are also loyal employees subject to the supervision of the governor. Your subpoena places them in a difficult position of choosing either to support the governor's decision to cooperate only with the personnel board investigation or to voluntarily comply with the subpoenas issued by the committee. End of quote. General Kohlberg, that paragraph contains a number of contradictory statements, and not that it's internally contradictory, but it expresses several contradictory positions. Number one, that there's the need to uphold the Constitution, and that includes, and I think you concede here, the right of the legislature to investigate. On the other, their desires to be loyal to the governor in this case. Isn't it true that that's not really a conflict? Because if they're under a subpoena, they only have the duty to obey the law regardless of their loyalty to the governor. Wouldn't their duty to uphold the law preempt and supersede their loyalty to the governor as a matter of law?
I think that's a correct statement.
Okay. Secondly, then They wouldn't voluntarily be complying with the subpoena, but they would be complying as required by Alaska law. True?
Right. And as mentioned, at this point, this was subpoenas that had not been served.
I'm not quibbling on that point. Once they're served.
But they would not be shorn of all their constitutional options or rights.
I will get to that and
sure.
in a moment. Now, let's focus on their right, either as individuals or as members of the executive branch. The individual right that you've cited to the court is their right to a full and fair and free hearing. Is that the only individual right constitutionally that you are asserting on their behalf, the due process of law?
The due process that they're entitled to have a process that complies with rules of the institution they're dealing with.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, with respect to their position as employees of the executive branch, are you asserting in this particular case, and then I'm going to get to the general, but I'm going to start off with this particular case, are you asserting that there's any other executive privilege such as executive privilege? Are you asserting that in this case?
I think there is an executive privilege that maintains that to state employees who work for the governor.
I would concede that in certain cases. Are you asserting that in this Trooper Gate situation here?
With respect to who?
Respect to the subpoenaed witnesses.
I guess without knowing specifically where you're going, I wouldn't want to say I'm going to waive their right to assert executive privilege.
I'm not asserting anything.
I'd have to go on err on the side of caution and say they have a right to assert executive privilege.
At the earliest stage when this letter was written, were you asserting at that point any blanket privilege, or were you going to wait until they were actually in front of the committee and propounded certain questions? At what point were you going to make the decision on whether to assert executive privilege?
They wouldn't have been in front of the committee. They would have been in front of Mr. Branchflower.
Whoever.
For this. I guess it would be depending on which attorney accompanied them to whenever Mr. Branchflower questioned them to assert the privilege where appropriate.
Okay, fair enough. Now, focusing away from that circumstance, because I'm not so concerned about what happened in October as I am on focusing on what I think may be the most important issue that's presented by this situation. It could be a hypothetical situation or whatever. The question I see here is the potential conflict between the legislature's constitutional right to investigate and conduct its legislative activity on the one hand, and the executive's branch to conduct its activity on the other in the form of executive privilege. And from the case of U.S. v. Nixon, which is the Watergate procedure, to the cases that have been cited in Alaska, I think the Alaska Supreme Court has recognized that there is an executive privilege, and they don't get into the work product thing as much, the deliberative executive privilege dichotomy, as just the broad executive privilege. I'd like to hear from you, sir, what you think the extent of the executive privilege is or should be vis-a-vis the right of the legislature to conduct its investigations, and you can limit it or not as you see fit, the subpoenas of witnesses and the compelling of answers under oath.
Okay. If I understand the question, I think I've partially answered this before, and I've tried to draw the distinction between our lawsuit on the 7 subpoenas versus some of the legislators' lawsuit against the whole process here. We were not making the argument.
I want to get away from that circumstance. I want to have a general answer.
Our argument never was that there wasn't a legislative right conduct an investigation, and that's repeated in this letter itself right at the beginning of that paragraph. Our concern ultimately with the subpoenas was that we felt there was an argument to be made that these were not in themselves properly issued. That doesn't mean that we felt that there couldn't be subpoenas that would be properly issued.
Please.
Yeah.
Disregard what happened in October.
Sure.
My question is a general, broad question. I'm looking at this hearing today as primarily a hearing to determine the extent of any potential conflict between executive privilege and legislative right of investigation, and how that should be dealt with legislatively, if at all, or should it be left up to the courts, or what? I want to get into the broader policies here, forgetting what happened in October.
Well, it's hard to entirely disengage from part of the lessons learned from this, but when you look at the Superior Court decision, you can recognize that there is a reluctance on the part of the court to engage into this particular area because of the concern about what's justiciable or not.
And I want to get away from the question of justiciability. You are not before a court of law. You're before a committee of legislators.
Right.
And at least this legislator is looking at whether there needs to be additional legislation defining the contours of the legislature's investigating procedures and or the executive branch's ability to claim executive privilege successfully. I'm looking at it as a legislator, not as a court of law.
I appreciate that. And through the chairman and Mr. Grunberg, I think the answer generally is yes, there is room for, because one of the big dilemmas in trying to address what the options are here is what exactly are the rules, because it's not a common procedure to launch a legislative investigation. And were there more clearly defined rules, we might not have felt a need to go to the court system to try to get redress. And as the court, again, acknowledged in the Superior Court decision, there was a sort of alarming element for an employee in the situation, is that the legislature is not bound by the same doctrines of fairness as a court would be. And that is, again, something that you could step away from institutionally by creating better rules and clearer rules to take away that concern that people have about, is this going to be a fair proceeding?
That is where I'm going. That's exactly what I'd like you to address, and I'd like us to think about this as legislators. And as I said to you before, that's a big question, it's an important question, and you may wish to respond in writing to that. But I'm wondering whether there should be something set out that sets up some rules so people know where they're coming from, and so they don't have to go into court, and they can make the process work without worrying about the fairness of it.
And through the chair to Mr. Grunberg, I agree with you there. I guess at this point, I think people will be reluctant to accept recommendations from my department on that issue, at least at this time.
I'm asking for it.
But I'm sure we could work on that if you really want that. And
I'm personally interested. I don't know if anybody else is, but I am, and I'm asking. And please rest assured that if I didn't want your advice, wouldn't ask.
No, I think we'd be happy to work on that.
And secondly, and I'm going to focus now.
Representative Grunberg, can I let you gather your thoughts for a moment on that point, Representative Coghill?
I just have one more question.
All right.
I'd like to focus, if I could, sir, on the final paragraph of your September 25, 2008 letter to Senator Elton. May I read the paragraph, please? Finally, as you noted in your letter, I did not respond to your questions concerning specific advice and conversations, that to the senator. As I hope you can appreciate, my obligations to my clients prevent me from disclosing such information. So my subsidiary question to you is, apparently you are referring to your attorney-client privilege there. And my question to you is, that privilege is set forth in some detail in the Alaska Rules of Evidence. Those rules of evidence do not apply, have not been applied per se, in the course of legislative hearings. And I do not know whether the attorney-client privilege as a matter of law does apply in legislative hearings, and if so, to what extent. So my second question is, what should the rules of evidence be, and specifically this rule, in the course and scope of legislative hearings? Should there be such a rule or rules adopted by the legislature? And if so, should we take them from the rules of court or what? So my first question is a general question of what should the rules be in conducting hearings vis-à-vis executive privilege, and any other issues that you may think warrant that. And secondly, what should the procedural rules be, specifically rules of evidence, and the one that came up in this paragraph was the attorney-client privilege. And with that, I'll conclude. I would think we probably need those answers in writing. I don't know. Whatever the chair wishes.
Through the chair to Representative Grunberg, we would definitely assert that attorney-client privilege does not disappear just because it's a legislative proceeding. I think that that would go absolutely contrary to your previous set of questions about how do you make this process better. I don't think you improve the atmosphere of process in our country by suggesting there's a forum where attorney-client privilege does not apply. That seems to be...
If that is the case, finally, then the question is, should we set those out in statutory form or other written form of procedure so it's not just a casual conversation with you and me on January 28, 2009, but it's set out in a form so that the people in 50 years from now know what the rules are.
Yeah, I would hope that it's would be clear enough that anything that would establish something to the contrary, that there was no attorney-client privilege, would be understood to be something that would have to go to court, because that is a fundamental understanding of most people in this country. But with regard to other things, I think there is room for clarification that could have avoided some of the tensions that we've had here.
I would not be so sanguine in that answer, because it's unclear from me, to me anyway, as I think the other legislators have said, exactly whom you represent and whether you can, consistent with the canons of ethics, represent, quote, clients with conflicting points of view, as seems to be the case here. And in fact, under the rules of evidence, as you know, that particular privilege cannot be asserted in a situation where there is such a conflict, and it's only asserted in a confidential setting. And if in fact you're asserting a privilege on behalf of some clients where the other clients may have different views, or it wasn't done in a confidential setting, the initial conversation where it's unclear who you're representing, whether you're representing people with conflicts and stuff, it just is not that clear, particularly in this state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, to Representative Grunberg. You may quarrel with how we came to represent some folks, but I think ultimately we would quarrel with the notion that regardless of whether we represent them or someone else did, that they would still have an entitlement to an attorney-client privilege in the course of...
And maybe part... maybe as part of these rules we're thinking about establishing, there should be some rules set up defining in some detail, and I know there are some statutes on this subject in Title 44, of exactly what the rules are for defining conflicts of interest within the Attorney General's office, how they are determined, who determines them, what the rights of appeal, etc., because I think you were walking right up to the edge of the envelope in this one, maybe over.
I'm going to come back on that point myself. Representative Coghill?
Well, I think there's enough room for both of us to be on the edge here. I think as far as both legislative action and administrative action, trying to figure out how to deal with it. So I'm going to say that for my part, what I'll be watching for is what can we do to better define a process where we would require information from the executive branch and have a clear pathway to make sure that our authority is respected. So I'm agreeing with the chairman in that I feel that a barrier to this legislature is unacceptable when it's requiring information that's well within its authority to execute. So, but first of all, I think we probably may have failed on some accounts. So I'm gonna talk. First of all, I'm gonna ask you about. You said earlier on about the nature of the subpoena, so I'm going to ask you a little bit about helping me understand what you meant by that. Secondly, we in the legislature did, in fact, have the subpoenas, and then I guess the question I need to know definitely, and maybe for those who are listening in, did they, in fact, get given to the people who were supposed to get them? And I just need a definite answer on that.
Yes, they did.
Okay. And so then, based on their refusal, we also had a process that we did not follow that is under 2425030, which really anticipates that the legislature is going to be in session whenever you issue this type of subpoena. And if they are if there's a refusal to answer those subpoenas, then we have a resolution that is required of us to come forward with. So the two things I think that maybe the legislature stands to benefit from and can be actually accused of some confusion is that we were issuing with subpoenas requiring two committees to act in concert. One was the Legislative Council, one was the Judiciary Committee, who was working in concert with the Legislative Council. I think that might have created some confusion as to the nature of the subpoenas. But I think the ability to make those subpoenas stands very clear. So I guess the question is, do we stand in danger, or should we anticipate having a law that would go in Title 24 that gives us clearer direction what should happen in the interim session when there is no legislature and we cannot convene to get a resolution in a timely manner. So did you contemplate that at all?
Yes, through the chairman, Representative Coghill. Again, I would. The subpoenas were all served.
Okay.
And our position, again, was that we made a timely request for relief from them, and so I quarrel with the term. They refused to comply. The refusal to comply is in tandem with trying to exercise what we believe is our constitutional right to question the very thing that you're touching on, which if you walk through our complaint about the subpoenas, that it's very much parallels part of what you're describing is the legislature was not in session, and that's part of what we understood to be part of the process for these to have been issued in a way that would have been proper subpoena. So you have touched exactly on part of our complaint about
one other question on that. So and I'm open to remedy that because I think that's something that in this committee we can look at and say we have this authority. How do we use it properly? And so I'm open to that discussion. I guess then the other question would be I should have jotted it down. The depositions that we required because of our subpoena, would it be anticipated that the testimony would be required before a committee and done publicly as over against having them done in deposition form privately as they were done?
In the case of the seven, through the chairman, Representative Coghill, in the case of the seven, I think what ended up happening is after they agreed to comply that they sent statements instead of depositions. What I know was happening is that these were, in general, Mr. Brenchler was conducting depositions in private. I don't believe the legislature ever had a deposition conducted in front of it in the course of this proceeding.
And I guess, Mr. Chairman, I guess I would ask us as a body, when we're going to exercise this authority, should we require that it be done publicly so that they give an answer for themselves publicly, or did we miss something by having them done in the manner in which they are done and then delivered to us in report form? And so I think we need to probably ask ourselves a question, could we have done that better to exert our authority? Just a question.
Point made, and on that point, I'll get to you in just one moment, Representative Holmes. My recollection was that the subpoenas were issued for those folks to come before the full committee, and that they were given the option of being deposed in private with Mr. Brenchler, with or without counsel as they saw fit, and then to expedite matters because there was this extremely pressurized external event, which was the United States election of our 44th president, written remarks were accepted in lieu of a deposition in some cases is how I recollect it. And just for the benefit of those in the room, the rule that you're referring to in Section 24 is that subpoenas can be, if I'm correct in my recollection, subpoenas can be issued by a committee, but action on somebody who disobeys the subpoena must be taken by the full body. And we were in the interim, and so there was no way to convene the full body. Therefore, not unlike a call of the House today during our House floor session, which the Sergeant of Arms could have charged a state trooper to come find somebody who was hiding in a bathroom or down the street, and we right. lost that right by not being in by not being in the regular session. That's my recollection of events, General. I want to take another go at trying to figure out who you were working for, because I'm still not quite satisfied with the way that we the way that we vetted that question. And so, by way of analogy, here's how I'm going to put it to you is, I have attempted on behalf of my community to bring to open up a rate regulation docket for Fairbanks Natural Gas, and I believe that the Attorney General that we worked with, his name was Daniel Patrick O'Shaughnessy, I thought, and I was quite surprised. When I went to his section to learn how many Chinese walls the Attorney General's office is capable of having for one particular subject. And so, in fact, we were going to have an attorney who would defend, who would look into a docket. There would be another Attorney General who would consider whether my recollection isn't extraordinary, but there was another attorney who was on the other side of that issue, and then, in fact, there was another attorney for the RCA, and I was surprised to learn that the Attorney General's office is capable of having three different deputy attorney generals all address the same issue from it, and I think Chinese wall is that's mm-hmm. I think the right term. And so I'm a little bit surprised in this situation that for a matter of such sensitivity and delicacy that, frankly, you and your staff weren't agile enough to erect similar Chinese walls. And I think that's what I was trying to get to, is I don't understand what happened. You got the governor, you got the people of Alaska, you have the legislative branch, you have the seven people or the four people or the 11 people. And I thought it was just sloppy to me. And so that's what I'm still driving at, is I understand why we can't perfect when it comes to separation of powers for the legislative branch and the executive branch, which is tantamount to the whole Constitution, the way our whole system works. Why can't we handle that as cleanly as we're able to handle a letter to the RCA to approach the court on a rate regulation case? I think that's another way to put my question. Could you please respond?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. First, it's not Mr. O'Shaughnessy, it's Mr. O'Tierney.
Yeah, he's great, by the way.
Nice. In regard to your confusion, sir, about who we represent, and you named four parties, we clearly never tried to represent the legislature in this matter.
Quite correct.
We gave the governor independent counsel. We did not represent her.
But not initially. Not initially, because I remember we had that exchange.
Because, well, you had an exchange with me on a different reason for that. You perceived there to be a personal conflict. The reason for the governor getting independent counsel was staff looking ahead to where are the conflicts that are likely to arise here, given the governor is the governor and also in charge of, for example, public safety, which was a part of the issue here, and we represent public safety, and so in anticipation of where this could go, it just made more sense to keep the governor separate, and that's what we did. And yes, not initially, because this is at least an unprecedented and recent memory issue to come before us, but we did fairly early on, within a couple of weeks of when this got going, address that and try to take care of that. And so ultimately, we represented the state employees who were brought into this not really as accused of anything, but as people who were seen as witnesses. We're talking about us representing them as witnesses or seen as components of an overall investigation.
My next question, still don't quite get that, but I appreciate your answer on the record. To me, if the RCA is more agile, than a matter of this sensitivity, then it was a failure on the part of the Attorney General's office. Next question for you, General. If a legislative subpoena was legally issued, why should it matter what the nature of the underlying investigation is? Because so much of this went to, is it the Branch Flower Report? Is it the Personnel Board? And again, I was just dissatisfied with the way that it rolled out. Can you speak to that for
yes,
me, please?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. If we had agreed with you that it was properly issued, it wouldn't matter. You're right.
So then your point of view was that you did not believe that it was properly issued?
That's right, and that's what the lawsuit in court was all about.
So what part of three committee members, a majority of the Senate Judiciary Committee, voting in that way, signed by the Senate President, what part of that was incongruous with your understanding of how the legislative branch is supposed to go about issuing subpoenas? What do I not get?
We believe that the legislature did not expressly authorize the legislative counsel, Senator French, or the Senate Judiciary Committee to conduct an investigation during the interim between legislative sessions. We believe that the legislative counsel did not authorize the Senate Judiciary Committee to play a role in the investigation that Mr. Branchflower is conducting. We believe the legislative counsel granted, if the legislative counsel granted any implied authority to the Senate Judiciary Committee to assume jurisdiction over the investigation that Mr. Branchflower was conducting, that grant constituted an invalid delegation of legislative power in violation of the uniform rules of the legislature. We believe that the subjects described in the subpoenas were outside the jurisdiction of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and that the Senate Judiciary Committee did not authorize Senator French to issue subpoenas to plaintiffs requiring that they bring any, quote, any relevant material and proper books, papers, or documents, end of quote, when they appeared before that committee. Those were our specific reasons for filing the appeal.
How'd that go for you?
It went at the Superior Court level. The judge determined that this was ultimately not justiciable, and we have an appeal filed, not because the people continue to wish to defy the subpoenas, but out of concern that we protect as best as possible them from any sanction that might occur. And that appeal was not filed until it was clear our timeline to do so was running short.
So let me paraphrase then. You didn't have any respect to or belief that these were authentically issued subpoenas by the Senate Judiciary Committee. Is that correct? What do
That's
I not get?
An absolute statement. I would say that we understood there was a proper basis for the legislature to have an investigation and that they had the right to issue subpoenas. We don't think they did it right.
And how should we have done it? What would have satisfied?
If you had done those five things I had read off, then that would have.
Can you repeat them for me then? So let me listen carefully to these five things. Do we have? Do I have a copy of this?
This is the actual lawsuit.
Okay. Could you repeat those five things, and I'll try and write them down or summarize them for me again. I'm not being coy. I'm not a lawyer. I'm just an irritated legislator.
The legislature did not expressly authorize the legislative counsel, Senator French, or the Senate Judiciary Committee to conduct an investigation during the interim between legislative sessions.
Okay. Please explain that one to me.
The legislature did not authorize the investigation.
All right, and why should they? What basis in law is there for that point? And I'm just asking a question. I don't know.
We believe that that is required by the process.
But I thought when I read the rules that 24 was pretty explicit. It said any committee signed by the presiding officer of that body. So how did you make the leap in the executive branch to the full body?
We didn't make the leap. The legislature was not in session when this occurred.
It says a subpoena requiring the attendance of a witness before a standing or special committee of the legislature may be issued by the chairman of a committee when authorized to do so by a majority of the membership of the committee and with the concurrence of the president or the speaker, or with the even I know the difference between may, shall, and or. Even I get that, and it says or with the concurrence of the House or Senate. So in this particular case, we were impaneled. It was the 25th legislature. The Senate Judiciary was doing their job. Three members said yes. It was signed by Lida Green. What do I not get about number one?
We believe it was necessary for the whole legislature to approve this.
Okay. All right. Well, then we disagree certainly about number one. What's number two?
The Legislative Council did not authorize the Senate Judiciary Committee to play any role in the investigation that Mr. Branchflower is conducting.
And do you recollect the vote of the Legislative Council?
This would be based on the record of what was officially taken as action by the committee.
I'm sorry. Let me start over. Was the 25th legislature still in session in this building when the Legislative Council took a vote?
I don't believe so.
The answer is yes. We were here. There were 12 of us. Representative Cocco?
Mr. Chairman, just on the first point, the part that you read was accurate in 2410B, but the C talks about when we're in interim, and that does, in fact, require a subpoena requiring the attendance of a witness before an interim committee established by either house of the legislature or by both may be issued by the chairman of the committee when authorized to do so by a majority vote of the membership of the committee and with the concurrence of, of the president.
Yes,
that's right, you're right. I'm sorry.
Yes,
I was brushing along there. The concurrence part didn't get my attention right off.
Me too, yes, sir.
Sorry about that.
So number two, we were in session here. I don't recall, was it a special session? They all ran together. So we were here as a full body in special session. The Ledge Council voted 12 to nothing. What part of number two do I misunderstand?
We believe it was not done properly. And
why?
Well,
my name is Margaret Payton Walsh. I'm an assistant attorney general.
Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, the Legislative Council's motion creating the investigation or authorizing the investigation authorized Senator French to contract out and hire an investigator. And that's what the motion does. It sets up an investigation to be run under contract, managed by Senator French.
Yes.
It does not create or provide a role for either Senate or House Judiciary Committee in the conduct of that investigation. Purely coincidental that Senator French was the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee. The motion, the language of the motion, makes no reference to the Judiciary Committee. And that's the issue that we're trying to identify where in that second point.
I respect your point of view, but I respectfully disagree. Can you give me number three?
If the Legislative Council granted any implied authority to the Senate Judiciary Committee to assume jurisdiction over the investigation that Mr. Branchflower is conducting, that grant constitutes an invalid delegation of legislative power in violation of the uniform rules of the legislature.
So I gather by extension your argument number three is the same as number two.
No, Mr. Chairman, the uniform rules of the legislature.
Just for her, if you'd reintroduce yourself, it's just helpful when we have two people. Just housekeeping,
sorry. Margaret Payton Walsh. Mr. Chairman, the uniform rules of the legislature provide for the creation of a series of standing committees and describe the jurisdiction of those committees. The jurisdiction of the Judiciary Committees, both the House and the Senate, is matters pertaining to the Department of Law, the Alaska court system, and bills that are currently before the committee. Because the legislature had adjourned, other than the special session, there are no bills before the either committee. And the issues involved in this investigation were not issues pertaining to the Department of Law or the Alaska court system.
Okay.
So if the legislature wanted to pursue this investigation and issue valid subpoenas, that could have been done. The State Affairs Committee has jurisdiction over the Office of the Governor, the Department of Public Safety, the Department of Administration. If the House or Senate State Affairs Committee had issued these subpoenas, they would have been valid, valid issues. Under their jurisdiction.
Yes, ma'am. So if I understand correctly, you were defining the authority of the legislature.
Mr. Chairman, the legislature has defined the authority and jurisdiction of the standing committees. The uniform rules are very straightforward.
I understand. So you don't disagree with the intent of the legislature. You just think we were outside the authority of the legislative legislative branch.
Our understanding is that the uniform rules provide for the internal governance of the legislature. These subpoenas and this investigation was constructed in violation of those rules, and we felt that made the subpoenas questionable, and that's why we challenged them in court.
Okay. Thank you. Number four, please, General.
The subjects described in the subpoenas are outside the jurisdiction of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Again, that's judicial.
Yes, sir. That's clear to me. And number five, please.
The Senate Judiciary Committee did not authorize Senator French to issue subpoenas to plaintiffs requiring that they bring, and then this is subpoenas do become things, relevant materials, proper books, papers, or documents, and a vote on it here before that committee.
I don't understand that one. Can you?
The whole argument that these subpoenas were not authorized as issued.
Okay. Chairman? Thank you. Representative Cotto?
I have a question. All of this was initiated with Ledge Council. Ledge Council made a motion. The motion was adopted. Never mind the count. It was adopted. Do you have a copy of the motion itself?
I don't have a copy. I might have
we can get you one.
Do you have a recollection of the specific language that made direction? I mean, the specific words are not as important as I want to know what they authorized.
I believe they authorized Senator French to contact that. The Legislative Council in the interim typically does administrative and procurement
right.
matters, and so they would be the committee to issue a contract for an independent investigator.
So, if I can continue, they authorized Senator French to offer a contract to an investigator. Were there guidelines that said the investigator must be impartial, unknown, not related, not connected, or any of those guidelines? Were they there, or was it a free and open contract to anyone that Senator French wanted?
I believe there was language at the end of the motion along the lines of it'll be an impartial investigation. I can't remember the exact wording. I believe Representative Holmes might have it.
Mr. Chairman, I do have the motion in front of me. Would you like me to read the entire motion?
Or the germane portion?
Oh, it's a relatively short paragraph. Mr. Chair, I move the Legislative Council delegate their authority to the Council Chairman to solicit, award, and expend Legislative Council funds in an amount not to exceed $100,000 for the purpose of contracting for legal services to investigate the circumstances and events surrounding the termination of former Public Safety Commissioner Monaghan and potential abuses of power and or improper actions by members of the executive branch and prepare a report. Senator Hollis French will serve as the project director for the contract. It is the intent of the Legislative Council that the investigation be professional, unbiased, independent, objective, and conducted at arm's length from the political process. The report shall be submitted to the Legislative Council, Senate Judiciary Committee, and the House Judiciary Committee in a timely manner.
I think some of us might take issue with how objective that process was, if I recollect several days thereafter, some of the editorializing by the project manager. But that notwithstanding, I had a pretty clear understanding of what Ledge Council can do, and I also have the minutes from that meeting that indicate, I'll get to you in one moment, Representative Gunnell, that Tam Cook's remarks. Tam Cook said the first part goes to the issue of whether Ledge Council has the power to. I believe the motion will be to prepare a report. Ledge Council has the power to conduct investigations, including to issue subpoenas itself and to compel the testimony of witnesses and administer an oath. Sorry, it'd be too random to read this.
Mr. Chairman, I do have a direct quote here that would give you the. It was on, I think, minute 45:20. The question by Chairman Elton was if, in fact, we take a strike language, we put the council, does this in any way inhibit the ability of the judiciary chairs from issuing subpoenas to compel testimony from those they may prefer to get testimony at the subpoena? Tam Cook, no. If I may, through the chair, if you are talking about subpoenas that may be issued on the course of preparing the report versus any follow-up on any recommendation that results in a report, I don't see anything in that motion that prevents the investigator from requesting the assistance of a standing committee in issuing subpoenas if the investigator chooses to do so and if the project director is in agreement. So, I mean, it was understood as we went through there that we might enlist the Judiciary Committee. I think the point could be made that should have been Judiciary State Affairs. Maybe we could argue that. But because the project manager was the chairman of the Judiciary and it was a matter of legal questions, I think we probably would fly pretty good under that banner. And it was understood, even from me, who had some questions, that the Judiciary Committee would get involved. My concern at the meeting was that it would be only the Judiciary Committee, and I had a real big concern about that. And so I know we asked Tam that very question, and it was our understanding, at least, that they would be included. And the question of authority and standing of what issues the Legislative Council could look into over against what the Judiciary could look into was the reason for that support.
Thank you, Representative Cocco. Representative Gatto?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to go back to the authorization from Ledge Council. And I believe, as read by Representative Holmes, let me back up 1 second. How many potential investigators were available to Ledge Council to select the one person? Just tell me, is it 10 or is it 100 or is it 200,000 nationwide?
It's a lot. Chairman, to represent Gatto, that's not something that would come to us.
Right, but it's not one or 10. Because in the motion, they use the word unbiased. If you're looking for an unbiased investigator, is it possible that out of all the possible investigators, you would have picked a person who already knew the person being investigated and was somehow, and including his wife, knew the person being investigated? Would you consider that as having satisfied the requirement of the motion that Ledge Council presented?
Through the chair, to Representative Gatto, if you're asking me, that's not something that we have specifically brought to any legal challenge.
Representative Cocco?
Mr. Chairman, the only question that I'm going to be asking as we try to come to some conclusion on how we could have done better and what we could do better from here is probably looking at the interim committee thing, because I think we asked for a subpoena for those to come before a standing committee, of whom they never did show, and our ability to enforce that is diminished significantly by the way we have our statutes. And so I think if we want to clean up our act, we need to kind of clarify that. The challenge, I think, stands in the court. From everything I've read in the statutes, I think we're well within our right. I don't know that we acted very well within our right.
It's a different subject for another day. Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before I ask my next question, just to follow up on sort of the timeline of how things were done, because I agree with Representative Coghill's point that one of the things coming out of this might be a little bit of help in improving how we issue these subpoenas in the future and what we can do when we're in session and out of session. After the people failed to appear, the subpoenaed people have failed to appear on the day and time issued, that was reported back to the Senate President in accordance with our statutes. The statutes require that if somebody doesn't show up for a subpoena, that the Senate President be notified. Unfortunately, we were out of session, so there wasn't much of anything that the Senate could do about it. We've had a lot of discussion here about the Department of Law's views about the subpoenas that were issued at the time and whether or not they were valid. We now have a court, Superior Court decision. The Supreme Court affirmed. They have not yet issued their opinion, as I understand it, both. But the Supreme Court has affirmed that, yes, these subpoenas were valid.
Mr. Chairman, I beg to differ on that. The Supreme Court has held this in abeyance until June. What they did is they dismissed the other legal action, which would have questioned, which was not our action, the whole process.
Can you walk them through just to be sure I'm clear?
There were two lawsuits.
Okay. They dismissed the other lawsuit, but didn't they affirm the Superior Court on that issue, but not the other?
Yeah, we still have a lawsuit that's current they would address, in theory, in June.
All right. Thank you. My error. Well, then that's going to really complicate this, because I was going to ask you, in light of this, do you now believe that the subpoenas were valid?
No, we believe we have a legal argument. I think that what I would emphasize in terms of the legislature's options here is that in addition to the letters that were issued, another letter was issued to the then Senate president also indicating that all seven of these people had made themselves available and offered written and sent mm-hmm. in written statements. And so, and they had agreed to submit to the subpoena after the Superior Court decision. The lawsuit is preserving their options because of the concern of where does this go next. But they have tried to comply, mm-hmm. they have made themselves available, and they have provided written statements. So what is available for the legislature is to bring this to a conclusion, because there was a motion to dismiss by the legislature, which was denied by the Supreme Court. And the merits of the case were put in abeyance until June, because the legislature does have the option of saying enough is enough, and they have made themselves available, and they agreed to submit to the subpoenas at that point.
Okay. In light of this, I was mistaken on some of the timing on some of this. I'm trying to figure out how we go forward is what I'm trying to do with this line of questioning. I'm trying to kind of move beyond what happened before and follow up on Representative Coghill's interest in how do we do it better in the future. From your standpoint, what do we need to do in the future to make sure that we are issuing what you view as being legal subpoenas?
Well, I think we've laid out in our complaint what we think would be. I mean, we recognize that there is a legislative right to issue subpoenas. That is not challenged here. What I think would help is something along the lines of what Representative Grunberg was talking about, is anticipating that if there is another legislative investigation into something in the future, to spell out what the rules and requirements would be under those circumstances and spell out this is how subpoenas will be issued. You know, it's unlikely that any future circumstance is going to exactly track any past one, but I think one of the things that became apparent very quickly was that this is kind of uncharted territory. And, you know, was it improper for the legislature to launch an investigation? No, that's not our argument. Were there better ways to handle it? You know, a representative, Chairman Ramirez, indicated he thought that the personnel board route was a whitewash. We don't control the personnel board at the Department of Law, and it's set up as a mechanism which arguably in this case would have been less controversial and easier for everyone to understand what the rules were ahead of time. Would that apply to future investigation? Not necessarily. A future investigation may not just lend itself to that, but there were other options available here which would have been easier and less controversial. But I do think a process can be made clearer for whoever next encounters a situation about what does a legislative investigation entail, who is going to do what, and you can chart out like you would in a court, this is what we know the process is. It's not as clear here. That's why we went to court, because to appeal to the legislature itself would seem to be not a very likely recourse.
With all, Mr. Chairman, if I may, with all due respect, the legislature doesn't control the personnel board either, and I think many of us stand by our belief that it was our right to at least look into this situation within our own branch.
Yeah, through the chair to Representative Holmes, I'm not quarreling with your right to investigate, and I'm just saying that if it had gone to the personnel board, I would hope you don't control it. that would not be the purpose of the personnel board is set up to be a third party.
A question by request from Representative Olson. How much time and monies have been spent by the Attorney General's office on fighting the subpoenas?
I'm sure that can be determined. I mean, we have undoubtedly got a way to break down the hours of our staff on that.
Okay. Other questions for Attorney General? Representative Grunberg, if you would just to reiterate for the benefit of the committee what you would, the request that you're making in writing, and then...
Oh, you want me to send a letter and copy everybody?
Yes, but if you would just verbalize it again just so I can grasp it, and then Representative Coghill, also, if you would give me an overview of what gap you believe exists, and then the question that I will posit you with finally after that, General, it goes to intent, you know, the intent to honor the wishes of the legislature. And so the question I have for you is, what would you do? Would you behave the same way over again? Would you handle it precisely the same way? And what kind of rules do we have to have in place in order to get the Attorney General's office to abide by the wishes of the co-equal branch of the legislature and quit playing by the Jordan rules? You know, the Jordan rules were, you know, Michael Jordan got to travel, he got to foul, and the rest of the NBA couldn't play by those rules. And that was the way that some of us regarded what unfolded, and that was the offense that some of us took. So with that, if you would restate what your request is going to be in writing, and it would be helpful to have it in writing, Representative Gruenberg, and then Representative Coghill, if you would give us a similar kind of answer.
Okay. What I would like, General, is your suggestion for rules that could be established concerning legislative hearings and claims that the executive branch might make to decline to either participate or answer certain questions, produce certain documents, including but not limited to any potential claims of executive privilege. And then secondly, what procedures should be followed? Should the rules of evidence be applied wholesale or maybe in part?
And you'll put that in writing to the committee?
Oh, yeah. I used the example of the attorney-client privilege. That just happened to be one rule. And if in fact there are authorities pro and con the positions you take, if you would like to reference them, that'd be fine. I realize that that's the extent of what I'm saying. Now this is Max editorializing here. This is a large project, and I'm interested in quality rather than speed. It's obviously something that you'll want to consider very carefully, and then the legislature will want to consider very carefully. And we may get it before the end of the session, may not. But I'm not going to let the ball drop. I want to see what we can do here. And you may decline to answer before you get the opinion from the Alaska Supreme Court in the case. That may be helpful in answering some of these questions. So I guess I would not be adverse to your answering preliminarily and saying, this is how we're going to proceed in our timeline. But it's an important thing, and it's an issue of first impression in this state to a large extent.
Thank you. Representative Coghill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I'm just going to kind of zoom in on three different areas. There was a question on delegated authority. Could the body with the president delegate the authority, and do the uniform rules necessarily have to direct that authority? I think that's a question that is going to be brought up by the court, but I think we're also going to have to talk about how two committees may work in concert. There was a question in, for example, the Legislative Council, what authority they had to look beyond administrative matters, and then what the broad authority of the judiciary was. And so I think we need to ask ourselves that question. The other one is, if we're going to be able to issue subpoenas, which I think we are, I don't want to cede that, but we also have to have the ability to enforce those. And we obviously have a glitch in our statutory scheme as far as making sure that that is enforced, because they anticipate the full body being present for enforcement, but give reasons for subpoenas during interim. So it doesn't mix well. Then the other thing is the question I had on should we have clear rules on what comes before a committee and what can be done in preparation for that committee? For example, the depositions, subpoenas, the statements, because I think the very issue that is going to come up on attorney-client privilege, what should be public, what should be allowed to be private, we need to have that discussion. Then the other thing is, that kind of adds to that, is where do we bump up against criminal issues? And I think that's the procedural question, is I don't think it was ever intended to be a criminal investigation, but it investigated things that had criminal natures to it. And then we hit an edge, and I think we just need to define that. If we're going to go down that road, we probably need to ask ourselves how to define that. And I'm going to cede a little bit to his written paper to find out if we're going to get that conversation.
Mr. Chair? Follow up on that for just a moment. You might, General Kahlberg, take a look at several sources I'm going to mention to you. Number one, of course, the Constitution. Number two, the Uniform Rules. Number three, Mason's Manual answers a lot of these questions. And there's a whole chapter, maybe more than one, on legislative investigations. And also Sutherland statutory construction. I think that has stuff in it, too. I mean, I'm looking at these, and we're going to flesh these out. But we're not entirely inventing the wheel here. But we need, as Representative Coghill said, to have a procedure to conduct investigations, compel production of evidence and enforce those, even if it's after a sign a die adjournment. And there's, I know the members have some legal opinions on this in citation to an Arkansas case and a few things. And we will make available to you, unless there's objection from the chair, any member of the committee, all of the legal opinions we've got that have been distributed. So you have the benefit of the thinking that we've been given so far, and we will spread your response among the members also. There are no secrets here.
Thank you, Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just two more quick lines of questioning here. The first is going back to the lawsuit, because I apologize. I was under a mistaken impression, so now I'm trying to get my head around it. Originally, there were two separate lawsuits that were filed, and they were combined for the purposes of the hearing. The Superior Court ruled, the trial court ruled on both of them. They went up on appeal to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court, I'm understanding, ruled on one of them, but deferred the other one until next summer?
Right, this summer.
So I'm good so far? Okay. So if I'm correct, the one that the court ruled on was the one that was brought by other members of this legislature.
That's correct.
And the one that is still alive and still waiting for argument is the one that was brought on behalf of several of the people who were subpoenaed?
Right. It is the seven people who were subpoenaed.
Okay. Who is representing? Is it the Department of Law that is representing those people?
These seven, yes.
These seven. So currently the Department of Law is suing the legislature in an ongoing open case.
That's right.
Okay. All right. I was unaware of that. I just wanted to make sure that I was understanding it correctly. Okay. The second line of questioning is on conflicts. I concur very much with the chairman's comments earlier that from my perspective it was sort of messy. I understand that your department wears a lot of hats. Not arguing with that. You wear a lot of hats. You represent at times the governor, at times the legislature, at times individual members of the executive branch, at times the interests of the state. There's lots of things. As the chairman said, in some proceedings you might have three or four different roles within the same proceeding. It gets messy. How are we going to do it better in the future when there are potential conflicts of interest among the groups of people that you represent, or potential conflicts of interest? What can you do better in the future to make it less messy?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that's been left floating here, and it makes it more confusing than I think it really is the idea that there were multiple parties, that some were represented and some weren't adequately, or that there's some confusion there. There's really two parties that were needing legal representation here, the seven people who received subpoenas and the governor. To suggest that the people needed a separate counsel, I'm not sure that what that would be in this instance in terms of appearing to do what. And so, and of course, the legislature is the other party, and so if anything had to be done dramatically differently, I guess you could say you could have in place a mechanism that would say, oh, we've been down this road, governor gets independent counsel today instead of a week into this. The idea that, you know, it's been thrown out, there's multiple people, different people getting different representation, I've not really followed who the conflicting representations are in this instance once the governor got independent counsel.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, if I may, I just come back to the idea that the primary goal of the Department of Law is to represent the best interests of the state. And,
right.
And it seems like in this case you have the department going. I'm not entirely convinced that all of this isn't a little bit in conflict.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you agree to the chairman, to Representative Holmes, that these folks were entitled to some legal representation?
I do.
There may be a different mechanism that's not in place that could do that, but absent that, someone had to step up to the plate for them.
Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Attorney General, for being here today. In June, or whenever the court does make their ruling on the lawsuit that is still pending, I can think of a couple different scenarios of ways that it could turn out. What position potentially could the legislature be in if the court would rule, I guess the proper way to say it is, for the seven and against the legislature?
Well, I think in that instance you would have clearly confirmation of our view that these could have been done differently. It wouldn't undermine the legislature's ability to do an investigation. It would clarify how it should be done. Another option is that the legislature recognized that the seven people who are the subject of this lawsuit have agreed to submit to the subpoenas, have agreed to provide information, and you could bring it to a conclusion and end this process and work on preparing rules in the future for whoever might encounter this next, to bring it to a clearer process should there be another investigation in the future.
A follow-up, and this is a really simple question, so probably for simple minds, so bear with me. So if we as a body and the other body and in your department were to agree that we were going to, I'm going to use the word, put this to rest and sit down and come up with ways that if this ever happens again, and I hope and pray that it never does, but that if it does, that it's handled differently, the lawsuit could stop, could go away. Names could be cleared, we could move forward.
Through the chairman, Representative Dahlstrom, yeah, you can bring the lawsuit to an end and end the whole process.
All right, thank you.
And then finally to my question, General, would you do it over the same way? Would you make changes? What were the situation to arise again? How would you handle it?
everything's always clear in retrospect, and sure, things would be done differently. Do I know exactly how I'd walk through it? I think ultimately I would still come to the conclusion that the people involved were entitled to legal representation. How it would be achieved might have been simpler, more direct, quicker. Would that mean they wouldn't have asserted their legal options as they are, I believe, entitled to do? That would have made them different? Maybe, maybe they wouldn't have. But I think ultimately what we were doing was trying to do the right thing, and I think generally speaking we did try to do the right thing properly.
So you would have advised, you would have advised your clients to ignore the subpoenas?
No. Never did advise them to ignore the subpoenas. I would advise them of their options and leave the choice up to them, as we did in this instance.
All right. Any other final remarks, Representative Gatto?
Just a,
Representative Grunberg.
If I may, it's just a detail question that that's just been nagging on me. Ledge Council's motion did not mention a date to conclude anything. Correct? I mean, they didn't say conclude.
Eventually, someone inserted a date. I don't know when that happened. So.
That's really the question. If did the Judiciary Committee suggest, demand a date to conclude the investigation, or did Mr. Branchflower on his own said, listen, I need to get this thing done by? I'm wondering where the date originated.
Through the chair to Representative Gatto, I don't know where the date originated. It didn't originate from us. I know that.
With me, Representative Gatto.
Oh, that's the answer?
That's the answer.
Thank you.
We didn't want anything that pushed into November. We thought it was entirely inappropriate. And so in a meeting with the vice chair and myself and Senator French, in the only discussion I believe that we had with Mr. Branchflower, and then in when we conferred afterward, I believe, with Senator Huggins, we agreed that October was far more appropriate, that it was important for this material to come out to satisfy the needs of the Alaska legislature, but 30 days was a dilutive enough period for not to have an impact on the national election, which was of particular concern to all in the room, but it had a unique concern, I think, because of our partisan relationship for Representative Dahlstrom, myself, and Senator Huggins. So that grew out of the only conversation that we had with Mr. Branchflower. So that's where that date came from. Representative Grunberg.
Yes, one other, thank you, Mr. Chair. One other source that I'd like you to take a look at in answering these questions are the rules of professional conduct, particularly those relating to conflicts of interest. Okay. And they generally are somewhere in the neighborhood of Rule 1.7 and following, and particularly as they relate to government service. And I know that the Attorney General's Office, Department of Law, has considered for many of these rules one law firm, and how you, and we've talked about Chinese walls and stuff like that, how you would maybe deal with some of these different and difficult problems by erecting Chinese walls, and whether those should be set up either in law, statute, or not just in procedures but in regulation, because I personally feel, and again I'm just talking for this representative, that these rules are sufficiently important for potential clients, members of the executive branch, and the legislators, and the general public and the press, that they shouldn't be hidden in some manual procedure somewhere, but they should be somewhere out that's readily made public, like the like regulations, and go through the regular Administrative Procedures Act in rulemaking, because this kind of an issue, the issue of dealing with conflicts of interest within the Department of Law, comes up not infrequently. And I don't know, are they right now the subject of regulations?
Well, I guess that's possible under certain circumstances, but other than the general rules that govern all lawyers, we have rules that, as the chairman was talking about, regulatory and public affairs and how we handle matters.
Are those in regs or where?
Is it civil manual policy?
I see. Well, it may be helpful for you to make that available to us. I'd like to see that. And frankly, I'd like to see that before I draft the letter to you, if you could, Mr. Tillery, get that over to us. And obviously, you have to guide your department the best way you see fit. But I think that this is very important, and it comes up not infrequently in the discussion of legislation. Everything from this hearing today to the legislation we're seeing from time to time on how the Attorney General should be selected and stuff like that. This is very, very important stuff. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Grunberg. General, I'd like to thank you for your forthrightness and for your candor.
Yeah.
For being open in expressing your point of view. Respectfully, you and I disagree on some things, but I have great respect for you and your principles, and we will just have to disagree on some of the judgment calls that were made in the heat of the moment. I thank the committee for its tolerance at this table for the breadth of opinion and sentiment and emotion that was expressed. We appreciate the correspondence that will take place between you and Representative Grunberg, some of the issues that were raised by Representative Coghill. I expect that the committee will revisit this again, probably at no time very soon, but sometime throughout the 26th legislative session, and it appears that very likely a judiciary bill should come out of this discussion, which would remedy some of the gaps that have been uncovered so that it will be clearer going forward. When the legislative branch issues a subpoena of the executive branch, that it shouldn't get hung up on technicalities that prevent the degree of disclosure that the legislature wishes to see the threshold which it wishes to see met, which appeared to be the disappointment, at least for myself and many other members. As usual, your commentary is forthright. You're always welcome here. I hold you in very high regard personally. A little frustrated with you and your capacity as Attorney General, but I like you very much, sir, and we appreciate your staff being here as well. And we'll just have to overcome this hurdle. Representative Grunberg, briefly.
Yeah. What I plan to do is, once I have a chance to review the civil manual, we'll get together a draft, and before I send it, I'm going to circulate it to the members of the committee for your views and additions and corrections, so that, and I don't know if you want it to go out under your signature or however you want to do it, but we'll make sure everybody has input.
On that note, I'll remind members that before end of business today, as long as we get the chart we're waiting for from the Office of Economic Development, you'll have a draft tomorrow. Yes, tomorrow. Right. By the end of business tomorrow, you'll have a draft copy of our report. General, we thank you and your people for attending. It's 3 o'clock. We're adjourned.